The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Before the podcast begins, I would like to share with you some exciting news. Louis has released a knockout second title, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Round 2 from the amazing life and times of legendary South Florida attorney Louis Ress takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s via a spell in a top-secret army department and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available now on Amazon. Just search Louis Ress. And before we start, don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. Today we'll be going over episode 25, Striking Out, 3+1.
First of all, I want to introduce you, Jeanette. You're so
Oh, thank you. I always forget.
This Jeanette, I'm doing this podcast with my good friend Jeanette Garcia, who's charming and intellectually very stimulating.
Oh, thank you, Louis.
It's always exciting to be with her.
Thank you.
Well, this is a baseball room, you know, three strikes and you're out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of strikeouts. All the heavy hitters in baseball, Babe Ruth included, struck out often.
Yep.
They don't tell you about how many times they struck out. They tell you about the homers they hit.
Of course.
But I wasn't perfect as an attorney by far. I was trying to just do my best. And not every client loved or trusted me. I wasn't the most terrific person in the world. I tried hard. And my friend Alvin Krasny, who was a terrific guy, used to tell me, he said, Louis, they all can't be winners.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story of striking out. Some of my cases were disasters.
That's very good of you to be sharing, you know, the failures as well as your successes.
Right. But you don't hear too many broadcasters or podcasters tell you about their shortcomings. They always like to be self-lauding and tell about their successes and their achievements. But I think it would be very good for the country if we were a little more humble.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try to be. I'm not an egotist. And this is all about... And I guess the lesson here is about our own imperfections,
mm-hmm.
and the need in society for people to be a little less aggressive and a little less self-aggrandizing and be a little more concerned about the feelings of others.
Hmm.
That's the ruling.
Okay.
I'll tell you, this starts off with a dry cleaning case. And I changed the names. This is my second dry cleaning story, by
mm-hmm.
the way. I'm famous for my dry cleaning, my dry cleaning law practice. But this is Mrs. Finer. That's not her real name. Was the wife of a well-known orthodontist. They were two brothers practicing orthodontics in North Miami Beach, mm-hmm. Florida. I used to represent the Finers when they built their home. And she would march through the construction site daily, nitpicking at the contractor. She nitpicked him into oblivion. Dr. Finer and his brother were pretty laid back, and everyone liked them. And he was a sweet, charming, good-looking, very athletic person, an excellent basketball player, and a tournament tennis star. And he was my oldest friend. By the way, I used to play in the sandbox. We had sandboxes when I was young.
Oh.
And we were one and a half years old playing in the sandbox.
Wow, you went way back.
Yeah, he was a great guy. And she was a short, wiry, tough lady. She reminded me of Nancy Reagan and Pat Nixon combined. These are tough, hard-skinned ladies. Well, she had a mean, squinty look to her eyes and a scowl on her face. And she looked as though she just swallowed a piece of lemon. She was continually asking me to take the contractor to task for insignificant things, such as the windows are dirty and one is cracked, or there's dust on the floor. Lady, it's a construction job. Finally, it became distasteful to keep finding the most minor faults, which always exist in construction work. And the builder was getting a little edgy. He was at the end of his rope, and he was thinking of walking off the job. So I wasn't surprised when she asked me to represent her in a dry cleaning case. And, you know, I had this experience in dry cleaning, representing the dry cleaners and representing my or helping my wife in a famous case. So and I had taken the course with the American Dry Cleaning Association. So I was a dry cleaning lawyer. You can't make a living doing that. Anyhow.
So what are the facts? Tell us a little bit about what her issue was there.
Well, Mrs. Finer, like any nice lady, dropped her dress off at the cleaners. It was a blue silk calf-length dress, and the dress came back a mess. The chemicals damaged the fabric, and the material was shredding. It was a disaster. And it was a $300 dress, and she wanted action.
What'd you do? What happened?
Well, when I told her that she could not sue for the matching gloves, belt, hat, and shoes, which is what she wanted me to
the
do.
The whole set.
Then, huh?
The whole set.
Right. She said she couldn't use them without the dress. They were not valuable. And I told her she couldn't claim that. She discharged me, and she gave me a good verbal lashing.
How did it go with the doctor? Were you two still buddies after that?
Or? Well, she was mad as hell, and I didn't tell her what she wanted to hear. So, of course, she told her husband, the doctor. She said, I don't want him to be our attorney anymore. So, needless to say, the doctor wasn't going to fight with his wife, and I was gone.
She won.
Yeah. So that's how you lose clients.
Yeah.
There was probably a more tactful way of handling it. But I failed to do that, and I'll tell you about that. Sometimes you have to be careful what you tell clients. You can't tell them they're wrong or they're bad or they're. You've got to be gentle with them.
You have to be very strategic.
Indirect.
How you.
Yeah. Okay, strike two.
Let's hear it.
I'm at bat, and it's a curveball, and I miss it. Strike two. It's too good to be true. What a case. Blind in one eye as a result of striking the dashboard in a rear-end collision. Mrs. Cantor, my client, was the driver. She was unconscious at the scene. She complained of difficulty with her vision, particularly blindness in her left eye. The doctors all agree that based on her history of excellent vision before the accident and the immediate loss of vision afterwards and a detached retina, which was causing her to be blind, it was caused by the trauma. In other words, the accident caused her to lose sight in one eye.
Right.
So, the insurance company decided not to tender the policy limits of the driver who ran into her. Not only that, but there wasn't even an offer. Well, when there's no offer, you better, for a lawyer listening to this, a young lawyer, if you don't get an offer, watch out. They're telling you there's a message. Anyhow, the lawsuit was filed. I filed a lawsuit, and discovery was taken. Those are the sworn statements or depositions, you know. And the liability was clear. She was hit in the rear. She was stopped. Still, there were no offers.
So what happened after that?
Well, I shouldn't say well. We went to trial. And I thought, it's a piece of cake. What the heck? You know, hit in the rear. She wasn't doing anything. She didn't cause or contribute to the accident. And everything went well. Our doctors all testified that she was legally blind in the left eye due to the detached retina, which by history was caused by the trauma of the accident. And she testified that she had never had difficulty seeing. She never wore reading glasses. I was ready to give a great emotional plea for justice and for a very large verdict. I mean, what would happen if she damaged the other eye, the right eye? Then she'd be blind.
Yes.
Blind.
Yeah.
So she was very, very vulnerable. And that was, of course, she couldn't have a comfortable, happy life knowing how vulnerable she was.
Of course. A lot
well,
of pressure.
Mrs. Cantor was the last of my witnesses. She was the plaintiff. And I turned her over for cross-examination to the insurance company's attorney. Well, the defense lawyer leans towards Mrs. Cantor, and he speaks in a loud voice. Mrs. Cantor, you came from Philadelphia, did you not? She says, yes. Now he's striding back and forth. And he's looking to the jury, not to her. He seems to be a cocky guy. And considering the trouncing I'd been giving him, I was wondering why he was so, tough.
Yeah, he's very confident, huh?
Yeah, he was very self-confident. And then he leans over and he says, Mrs. Cantor, Now, you tell us under oath that you had perfect vision before this accident, right? And she answers again, yes. He says, I can't hear you. Please say it again. That's how you get to, you know, that's theatrics. She says, yes. His eyes began to glow. His pace increased. Now he's walking rapidly. Now he's addressing the jury. And he's looking at the jury while he's asking the questions. And he's making eye contact with the jury, only glancing at Mrs. Cantor. He says, Mrs. Cantor, and you never had a problem with your left eye before, correct? Correct? Oh, boy. He was salivating as though he was going to devour her. And she said, yes, yes. This time she was very soft and quiet when she said yes.
Okay.
He says, Mrs. Cantor, is this your social security number and your former Pennsylvania address on this document? And he hands her a document. It was a patient information card. In those days, you could bring in documents as rebuttal without having to disclose them in the discovery procedure before the trial. In other words, you could pull a surprise.
Oh.
So she looked at it. She said, that's my social security number and my former address. Yes. He was now really agitated. He was red in the face. He was almost shouting. He said, this medical record from 15 years ago reads, referring to you, Mrs. Cantor. She comes in today for final discharge after having suffered a detached retina of the left eye as a result of being struck by a golf ball 3 months ago.
Oh, no.
That's wow.
It.
Strike three.
Yeah, that's it, right?
I was knocked out. I could feel the punch on my jaw and I was down on the floor. Muhammad Ali floored me. I was knocked out. Well, our witnesses, our experts felt sorry for me and they reduced their expert witness fees, which I had to pay out of my pocket. And of course, I never saw or heard from Mrs. Cantor again.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. She wasn't honest with you there.
Well, that's something, again, this really is a great chapter for pre-law and law students and young lawyers, because and I'll explain to you more what I'm getting at in some of the comments I'll make. But you have to investigate your case.
Yes.
And you have to make sure that the client is telling you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they'll lie to you. They think they're smart. So here we go with the next one.
All right. Let's hear it. What's the other
problem
in that
case? Strike two, by the way.
Yeah, it felt like strike three, right?
This one I call surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is another automobile accident with good liability. This time, Charlie Perlman came in to see me, and his chiropractor had run up a $10,000 bill, you know, what they do for highly questionable stuff, like, you know, massage and stretching exercises all kinds of physical therapy.
Uh-huh.
And Charlie was a very nice guy. He was retired. He was always telling me jokes. He was likable. He was tall, thin, and very happy. And he always told the oldest and the worst jokes. I mean, you know, like.
Do you remember any?
Yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, I do. A guy's sitting at the bar with another fellow, and they're in the islands in the Pacific. And he says, sir, is it Hawaii or Hawaii? And one guy says, I'll bet you $100 it's Hawaii. And the other guy says, you're on. I say it's Hawaii. Well, how will we find out? Well, the next guy that comes in the door, we'll ask him, and whatever he says goes. And they agree. They put the money up on the bar, and in walks an elderly gentleman. And as he walks into the bar, before he can say much, they say, sir, we have a question to ask you. Do you mind? He says, no, it's all right. They said, sir, is it Hawaii or Hawaii? He says, it's Hawaii. They said, thank you. He says, you're welcome. So those are kind of crappy jokes he told. Anyhow, you had to like him. You had to like him. And his wife, Hilda, was also very pleasant. She was always smiling. She was the kind of person that makes one feel that she's just glad to be alive.
Mm. And is this the kind of case you would normally take to court?
No.
Oh, okay.
I would never handle a case like this. It was a fender bender with very little damage to the car, you know, a couple of $100 denting the fender. And then there was a chiropractor involved, which they don't particularly reach me. Mm-hmm. And then there was no hospitalization. There was no operation. There was no objective evidence of any injury. No real fractures
mm-hmm.
or breaks in the skin or anything like that. No operation, no lost income. So it was not the kind of case that I could normally take. But he was such a nice guy, and I knew him from someplace else before he was a client. Maybe I had done a will for him or something.
Right.
And
you're trying
I
to do him
them.
A favor. Yeah.
So I wouldn't normally take. He had no evidence of any injury. He had some complaints of back pain radiating down his leg with numbness in his toes. Particularly his left leg and his left foot were numb. So this was consistent with a bulging or a herniated lumbar disc, protruding disc in the back. And although the x-ray showed some narrowing of the L5-S1 segment of the spine, that's the low back. Mm-hmm. So there was some kind of a evidence of something, mm-hmm. but not much. There were no MRIs in those days, and the orthopedic surgeon found low back muscle spasm, which is a tightening of the muscle. And there was some limit in his ability to lift his leg straight up in the air. When he's lying on his back, they lift up your leg.
Right,
it's called the Lesage test. Uh-huh. And he had about a 30% limit, but that's subjective. You can say it hurts.
Right. What did the orthopedist do?
Well, he didn't do very much. It was my orthopedist that I sent him to. Mm-hmm. He did a little bit of physical therapy, and he discharged Charlie with a 5 to 10% disability of the body as a whole based on the muscle spasm and the narrowing of the disc space, but primarily based on his subjective limitations. In other words, limited by his own physical ability. It says it hurts.
Right,
Ben Zobie says, I can't bend farther than when I'm doing it hurts.
Uh-huh.
So pain was the limiting factor.
Hmm.
The doctor gave an opinion that Charlie should not sit or stand or single position himself for over an hour. And he was unable to repetitively bend, that's continually bend, and he should not twist. He should not lift anything over 10 pounds. Those were the limitations. Charlie's retirement activities of bowling and golf were over forever.
Hmm.
So that's something that you can claim for some damages, that his golden years were not so
taken away. Yeah.
At his sworn statement or his deposition, where we could ask questions with the court reporter, the defendant's orthopedic doctor said that the independent medical exam that he conducted for the insurance company was conducted at his office, and he watched Charlie come out of his car and walk into the office without any sign of injury or disability. And when he left the office, he observed him through the window getting into his car, and he saw Charlie taking off and putting on his shoes in the office without any trouble.
Oh, Charlie.
He saw Charlie jumping into the car without any limitation. And then when he conducted the physical examination in the office, Charlie was restricted and complained of pain by performing these very same motions that he saw him doing when he wasn't aware.
At the trial,
the doctor would have to admit that he was getting quite a bit of business from the defense attorney and testifying for him regularly, and that he was really a hired snoop.
What did you do with this
when
you found out?
I wasn't happy. It's not a case, again, that I would normally undertake. I wasn't happy. I thought that the case had some value, but it was a case to settle. There was no mediation in those days, and we went to trial without any offer being made. That alone should have told me something. But I saw only the believability of my clients. They were so nice and sweet and refined, they were charming. And I think that was the issue, whether they were believable.
Hmm.
Well, all of my clients receive a letter from me right at the beginning of the case. And one of the items in the letter is the concern of the possibility that they may be followed and movies may be taken of their activities.
Right.
And I put in there, sometimes on a good day, we try to do some activities that we know better than to attempt, like changing the tire after the surveillance company has flattened it.
Huh.
Insurance company sends out investigators.
Right.
Sometimes they'll flatten the tire.
Just
and they'll
see,
wait for you to come and jack up the car, and they set you up, and you don't know who flattened it. They also lie in wait, hoping that you'll remove the cement block, which they placed in your driveway. They do things like that.
Well, I mean, I think that's great that at least you give them the heads up, right? Because
yeah,
some attorneys probably don't. Maybe they leave that part out.
90% of the clients don't listen to the advice, and maybe 50% don't even read the letter. So, usually, the client brings on his or her own problems and denies engaging in that activity at their sworn pretrial deposition. So the Perlmans did that. They swore that they hadn't mowed their lawn. They had hired a man to do lawn service at quite an expense. And Charlie hadn't bowled. He quit the bowling league.
Uh-huh.
And as for golf, the clubs remained in the garage gathering dust. Okay, and there were no other accidents in the interim, in between.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened next? Because if they have something on camera, that's it, right?
Well, under the pretrial rules, the defense had to disclose their surveillance, mm-hmm. their movies. And they sure did. There was Charlie bending over effortlessly to place the golf ball on the tee. Then he took out the driver and took a swing at the golf ball with his driver just like a pro.
Wow.
No hesitation, full backswing. Then there was Charlie picking up the golf bag and slinging it over his shoulder and marching down the fairway. Wait a minute, I don't believe it. There's Charlie jumping over a creek while he's carrying his golf bag. The bag must have weighed over 30 pounds. Charlie had denied playing golf under Rose.
No, Charlie. That's it.
That was the end of that.
That was the end of that.
The jury came back for the defense. They asked me to. I was going to drop the case, mm-hmm. but then I have a problem with a malpractice claim from my clients, so I had to keep going.
Right.
So we tried it, but we lost it. Hmm. Okay. Well, you know.
Sure, that was disappointing.
Yeah. The next one. I call strike four. Well,
okay, tell us
baseball,
all about it.
There's no strike four, but in the law practice, you can keep striking out.
Just keep striking.
There's no limit to the strikes. This one is an amazing story. It's called That Doggy.
Okay, let's hear it.
This is a terrific story. That doggy bit me. That's what the young boy said. So the family sat in front of me, telling me how their 10-year-old son won the National Baptist Outstanding Youth Award.
Wow.
It was a great honor, great honor. He was a national hero. Ben and his 6-year-old brother, Todd, were at the neighbor's apartment, and the kids were playing. They were in the courtyard of the apartment complex, and Todd went up to pet this 50-pound German Shepherd, which was sitting next to the wall on a long chain. Without warning, the dog bared its teeth and started after Todd, who was screaming and running. Ben went to the rescue, and as he was pulling Todd away from the snarling animal, the German Shepherd sunk its teeth into Ben's face.
Oh, no.
It took over 55 stitches and left a long, irregular scar down the entire side of Ben's cheek. The scar was permanent.
Oh, that's horrific. That's some story.
Well, both parents, Matt and Mary Bolton, were quite proud of their son, Ben. Ben had been awarded a medal and a trophy, which they showed to me. It was a big silver oval suspended on a red, white, and blue ribbon with a large cross crucifix on the top. And the trophy bore these following words: Hero of the Year 1990. Underneath, For Valor. Underneath, The Baptist Council of the United States.
That sounds like quite an award there.
It was a national
Very
award
prestigious.
Of valor from the church.
Yes.
Wow, it was impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the father was a painter, and he had a small independent painting company, and the mother was a secretary employed by the Baptist Church. She was plump, in her 30s, and smiled a lot. She wore colorful long-sleeve cotton dresses with a silver crucifix displayed outside and low-heeled shoes. He was sort of drab. He wore gray cotton pants and a brown polo shirt with brown boots. He wanted to know what the case was worth, and who would control the money. It's not uncommon for people to want an evaluation of their case in terms of financial recovery. Some even seek to borrow money against it, and I'll tell you more about that. I don't make promises. I found it's a big mistake to make promises.
Yeah, it's not ethical, right?
It's a question of the jurisdiction, whether it's ethical or not. And the same with lending money or helping out financially. Most jurisdictions preclude the lawyers, don't allow lawyers to do that.
I see.
Well, Ben was really a good witness, the young man. He could describe the incident like a motion picture producer. He used to say, "We had to go past that doggy to get to the doorway. That doggy went after Todd. I pulled Todd away before that doggy could get him, but the doggy bit me and it hurt." Well, the boys had just entered a courtyard and were trying to get to their friend's door. They had done nothing to provoke the dog. Neither of them had any history of misbehavior. Both were average students. The dog had no history of biting anyone, but it looked like a mean son of a bitch. And in dog bite cases, there was a presumption of liability.
Right.
You were responsible mm-hmm. for your dog's behavior.
Yes.
Well, I guess they went over the scenario about 30 times with young Ben, whom I had gotten to know and like. He was a sweet kid. He parted his off blonde hair down the middle. And he had a round, happy face. And his brother was too young to testify, since he really had no concept of taking an oath to tell the truth.
Okay.
So that's the rule of where you can testify as a child or not.
If
they understand right from wrong and can tell the truth and know the importance of telling the truth.
Is there like a way to evaluate that?
Yeah, you ask the kid some questions and you see if he understands. He understands right and wrong and not lying and the importance of telling the truth and the significance of swearing on the Bible. And when they're around 12 years old, they do know it.
Mm-hmm.
10, not so much.
Huh.
So it's around 12 years old where I find that you can have them testify. Well, my good friend Ray Pierce, the former circuit judge, was on the other side of the case. He was representing the Philadelphia Insurance Company.
Huh.
And they had the policy on the, that covered the landlord and the dog. And they told me that the demand was so high, thanks to Mr. Bolden's insistence that we make a big demand, they wouldn't even make a counteroffer or proposed offer.
Huh.
And that's what happens when your client controls the case, which they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, now we're offering, make a demand for $1 trillion and see what happens. Well, sometimes it's a mistake to demand too much. Usually it isn't, but sometimes it is.
And that's allowed for the client to be able to demand a certain amount?
You can demand anything you want, but when it becomes unreasonable, it doesn't help your case. The insurance company says, it's so high, we're not even going to make an offer.
Hmm.
When you come down to reality, then we'll consider talking to you.
I see.
So the case went to trial, and I remember cross-examining their plastic surgeon. Their plastic surgeon gets on the stand, and he says, because these guys testify for money. They have a business.
Of course.
He says, scars were not necessarily unsightly or bad. And in many cultures, they think that they're attractive.
Oh, boy. Here we go. What an argument.
He says, as you know, the Germans value dueling scars, especially saber scars on the cheek. They regard these scars as a sign of manliness. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Then he continued, the South Pacific Islanders, particularly the Maori in New Zealand, tattoo scars on their faces as a sign of beauty. Uh-huh.
Mm.
He said, he continued, in Africa and in Alaska, native tribe persons affect facial scars as a sign of respect for their culture. Well, he's looking at the jury, not me.
So many holes in that argument.
Well, he was a professional witness that had a prepared speech. And he was picking on the wrong lawyer, because a lot of lawyers sit back and let that happen and don't counter it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was my turn. And I looked at him and I said, Doc, do we live here in America now in 1991? Men isn't living with a tribe in Africa. You see, Doc, you're testifying here as a board certified plastic surgeon here in America in 1991 with Ben, right? Right. We're not in Alaska. We're not in the South Pacific. Did you train for many years to learn how to reduce scars? Did you do any training to learn how to put on scars?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good point. His entire profession is about that.
Right, Doc. How long are you practicing here? Over 20 years? At any time, did a patient ever ask you in your entire practice to come to you and say, Doc, will you put a scar on my face? Doc, did you ever recommend to any patient that they put a scar on their face in your 20 years of practice? Doc, did you ever professionally in your entire practice intentionally put a scar on anybody?
Yeah.
Doc, in fact, you charge substantial fees to reduce scars and to remove moles and skin blemishes throughout your entire practice to make people look nice and acceptable and clean-faced and scar-free in our society. Right?
Boy, you really cut him up there.
I did. I cut him up. Well, we were doing great after the first day. And Ray Pearson, my friend who was representing the Philadelphia Insurance Company, said he would call Philadelphia and see if he could get a reasonable offer. Mr. Bolton's eyes were shining. I learned a long time ago not to celebrate until the check clears the bank. And by that time, the excitement is over.
Oh, what happened? What came next?
Well, it was time for Ben to testify.
Uh-oh.
So young Ben, I had gone over young Ben's testimony until we all knew it by heart. His mother had heard it even more than I. She heard it at the hearings of the Baptist Church, at the awards ceremony, at the hospital, at the doctor's office, ad nauseum she heard it. So on to the witness stand goes little Ben. He's wearing nice white shirt, slacks, black shoes, hair slicked down, parted in the middle. Good boy. Good boy, Ben. We go through the story for the 100th time. No problem, he's perfect. And he ends, and then that doggy bit me and it hurt. Your witness. There, that means conclusion. It's time for the insurance company to attorney. Well, my friend Ray Pearson stands up, and he approaches the witness stand. Ray Pearson is about 6'6" and about 300 pounds. But to Ben, he looked like 12 feet tall, a giant. And his voice was deep, and it rumbled through the whole courtroom as though God was booming at Ben. Now, Ben, tell us what really happened.
Oh, boy.
Well, Ben looked at him and said, we were throwing rocks at that dog, and it bit me.
Oh.
Court adjourned. Court adjourned. Oh, that Ben. Was the end for the day. The jury walked out. And I'm, wow, disaster.
Oh, terrible.
We struck an iceberg, and we're going down.
So the little boy really did it.
Ray Pearson was always very kind to me. And we went back to his office, and he called Philadelphia, and he really didn't tell him too much about the success he was having in the case. Oh. And he just asked him if they wanted to make an offer or a settlement and how much would they let him go. And he conveyed it to me, and we grabbed it.
Oh, that's wonderful. That ended way better than it could have.
Well,
right?
I got lucky. And that's one of the things about having friends in the law practice who don't have an in for you, who will help you, even though they've got you by the throat, they'll give you a little room to gasp.
Yes.
So, and that happened to me in a fire case, which I'll tell you about, where I let somebody else have a breath of air instead of destroying
them. That's good, yeah.
So on the next day, the judge approved the settlement in open court. We presented it to the judge, and he discharged the jury. And in those days, we were allowed to speak to the jurors. And I asked the elderly Jewish grandfather who was on the jury, and he was the juror who I had singled out to try to sway, to try to have him work for me with the jury. And I asked him what he thought of the case. He looked me in the eye. He screwed up his face and he said, I wouldn't have given that kid 1 red cent.
Wow.
Strike five.
Oh, well, there's so much to learn here, Lewis, from all these strikeouts. Tell us about the rules of life for lawyers, or really for all of us.
Well, of course, the rules of life, you learn from experience and you learn from your own mistakes. And
That's
then true. If you have the ability to learn from the mistakes of others, you're exceptional.
Oh,
You're going to learn from
very
your own
wise
mistakes.
Person.
But you should figure it out. How could you avoid it? Well, you can listen to a kid. And he's sincere, and he's nice, and he's lying. And you don't know he's lying, and there's nothing really you can do. You can be skeptical. You find out a little bit about the child. You get his school records. You see if he's had any trouble in school. In this case, he was clean. Did he have any trouble with the juvenile authorities? No matter what the parents tell you, see if you can find out if he has a record in the juvenile courts. See if he's had problems with other children, with bullying, with accusing them of something. See if he's got a history of any psychological problems. You have to dig. You can't just accept the client's story. They could be using you. So you have to take a look at the client. You have to confirm the story. You have to confirm the history and the damages. And it takes some investigating. You can't just undertake a case. And all of these cases, if the clients, and you got to sit with the client, say, tell me the real truth.
Yes.
Don't fool around with me because I'll help you.
Yes.
And the same with witnesses. Witnesses can be honest and friendly, but two people can see the same accident from the same corner, street corner, and come up with entirely divergent stories.
Right.
I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
The color of the car, the speed of the car.
The memory. Memory sometimes isn't reliable.
It's perception.
Yeah.
It's not memory. It's what people see and perceive can be different depending on who's looking at it. And a lot of it comes from your what you want to feel or see. So it's very hard with witnesses. Sometimes it's good to have a witness and not call them, list them and let them go home. Sometimes you can kill your case by calling a witness that you didn't need that destroys you.
That's true.
You never know what they're going to say. You never know. Yeah. And that's the same with trying a case. There's a lot of cases that lawyers won't try and they figure they're terrible cases, and then but the damages are good. So they get into the case, and during the course of the trial, something comes up and helps the case tremendously.
Right.
Something that they never anticipated. Yeah. So those are the things. And treating the clients nicely is part of it, where the clients confide in you. Return their phone calls, be prompt, don't criticize them, listen to them, and you tell them that you can't guarantee the results. Now, if Mrs. Cantor had mm-hmm. been honest with me and told me that she had a problem in the history in the past of a detached retina in the very eye that's bothering her now, where she was hit, the doctors would have looked at it and possibly had grounds to say that there was an aggravation of her underlying condition.
Exactly.
And she wouldn't have been thrown out of court. If it was a workers' compensation case, and the employer was aware of it, and she had told them that she had a problem with the eye, and now it was aggravated, there's the special disability fund. The employer pays you and then gets compensated back from the state of Florida. So you don't prorate it. You don't say only that which relates to this accident is recoverable.
Right.
Now you get the overall whole thing. They merge, the two injuries merge. You get the whole thing, the total, mm-hmm. and then the employer gets back from the state caused by them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that the clients don't know that you know,
right.
And you can tell the clients, look, if this is a pre-existing condition, tell me, mm-hmm. and you should speak to them about that. And so, did you ever have back pain before? Tell me the truth. I'm not going to tell anybody. Tell me.
What has been in your history as a lawyer? What was one of the most interesting confessions in that regard, that someone told you something and it actually helped and you were able to help them?
Well,
do you remember one of those?
I can remember a lot of it, but I can remember one in specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Keystone Point here in North Miami. He had a terrible injury to his back, and he decides one day that he's going to rebuild his dock.
Uh-huh.
Even though he's got this horrible operation, a big case going on, he starts cutting up 2x4s and doing planking on his dock. And he's working for 2 days, lifting and banging. And at
Can't
the end of
good.
The second day, he notices that there's a guy 5 houses down across the canal taking pictures of him.
Oh.
He calls me up and he says, I got a big problem. I was doing all this stuff, and they took movies of me. I said, well, how do you feel? How does your back feel now? Does it bother you? He said, oh, yeah, I'm in pain.
I'm sure.
He says, I shouldn't have done that. I said, well, have you thought about going back to the doctor or the hospital, maybe the emergency room, and telling them you tried to build a dock and that it didn't work and that you had pain? And he did that.
Good.
And when at the hearing, in the workers' compensation case, they played the movies, and I didn't say anything. They finished the movies. I said, did you follow up to see if what happened to him as a result of doing this activity, which mm-hmm. he admits he did? They said, no. I said, we produced the hospital records showing that he had to go into the hospital for 2 days for treatments for his back because
Good,
he overdid
yeah.
it. And that was the end
you
of
had the evidence there.
That was the end of the effect of the surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
So if the clients are honest with you, you can help them. But they've got to be honest. When they lie to you, then you get caught and you become part and parcel of their fraud.
Yes. They make you look so bad.
Right. Then we talked about advancing money.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of clients come in and they want money. And they say, well, it's a great case. You undertook the case. It's got to be worth a lot of money. You're making a demand of $1 million. What about lending us $200,000? Well, lawyers cannot finance. It's against the ethics. So you
mm-hmm.
tell them, I get disbarred for doing that. But there are companies that will advance money to attorneys, to clients
uh-huh.
who are injured, make them loans, and they charge them interest. But some of the loans are contingent on their getting that money from the case. So there's no guarantee to pay it back unless they collect in that case.
Right.
Then they have a lien on the case. And they have that. That exists.
Is that advisable? Do you recommend it?
I don't recommend it. I think it's terrible because they charge a lot.
Uh-huh.
And but they have living expenses. So if somebody's totally disabled, they have no income, and they can't afford a nurse, food, clothing, gas, trips to the doctor, whatever. They don't have the money to lay out to cover themselves.
Yeah.
They're out of work. Sometimes it's good to borrow for living expenses if you can't get it any other way. Mm-hmm. And then you collect it back. So I'm not adverse to it, but I'm not in favor of it. It happens. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Then, you know, we talk about lawyers having a interest in winning all the time. We really are different from boxers. It's not this law practice is not a game or a sport, mm-hmm. and winning is important, but there's a lot of compromising and settling. You don't go into a boxing ring and say, I'll agree, you'll be the champ next time and I'll be the champ this time.
Right. Yeah.
There's a lot of give and take in the law practice that doesn't exist in competitive activities, and lawyers should understand that.
And you have to know when to sort of back down sometimes, right?
Right, and they also have to understand that when their clients lie, they're hooked in with it.
Yeah.
No matter what you say, you become, oh, you're the guy that represented that liar.
That's horrible.
So it's not a good thing to do. Hmm. And then there's a lot of misleading statements, too. You got to get your client to clarify stuff. After the deposition or after they make a statement, you've got to make sure that they can explain it away.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to look at it from a critical aspect and be able to tell them, well, look, here's what you said. How are we going to explain this away? So those are
really
the things.
Break it down before it gets to the point that you can't reverse it.
You know, I looked to see, and I was always wondering, how many cases go to trial? We always say that. You know, well, I always say 90% of the cases get settled.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, only 3% of the total cases filed seem to go to trial from the research I did.
Oh.
I thought that was very, very low.
That is low.
78%. Well, of the cases that go to trial, the plaintiffs only win 56% of them.
Hmm.
So that's interesting. In medical malpractice cases, only 27% of the plaintiffs win cases against doctors. Doctors win 70% of borderline cases. The malpractice cases are very tough to win. The average damage, what do you think the average damages in a case are?
I don't know. 150,000?
28,000.
Oh, okay.
That's all. And in tort cases, in automobile collisions, it's only 24,000.
Yeah, it's nothing.
And in contract cases, breach of contract is 35,000. So
even more.
I thought you'd be interested in those. Only 2% of medical malpractice victims sue. Okay.
Why do you think that is? People are intimidated or?
Well, of course, about $60,000.
So
if you have a permanent disability, if you have a scar, let's say, a little scar, the doctor's going to say, well, I don't have an eraser at the end of my scalpel.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a scar. When I cut the skin, you're going to have a scar. You knew that. So the jury, and then jurors are not too happy with particularly women who have facelifts.
Huh.
And these women are sitting on the jury and they think that you're a hussy to have a facelift and that it's not a refined thing to do. And it's against religion and against nature. So it's those cases are not easy.
Oh, I see.
And then the last thing I would tell you is about controlling the case, because I spoke about that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the client will say, you know, I want all this money. And the lawyer says, your case isn't worth that much. Well, the client actually controls the case, whether to settle it and whether to try it, or whether to make a high demand, whether to make a reasonable demand. Sometimes the demand is too low. The client says, I don't care. I just want to get out of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they can... it's, to me, very difficult to manage a client who's headstrong and decides to tell you how to. They can also tell you how to run the case. When they do
why'd
that,
they hire you?
Well, when they do that, they have the right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take any depositions. Don't do this. Well, I can't represent a client who's going to tell me how to practice.
Yes.
That's like a doc telling the doctor how he's going to treat you and what.
Just represent yourself.
Right. Well, they can't do that. It's technically difficult.
Mm.
So I think there's a balance between the client having input into the settlement of the case and the lawyer having input and how they try the case.
Mm.
And I've told clients that I couldn't represent them because they were trying to control the case.
Mm-hmm.
But insurance companies are professional. That's all they do. So if the client is knowledgeable, you don't know where they're coming from or what reasons they have, and they may not disclose them to you. And then you follow the client's instruction. And they say, don't take a deposition. Don't do this. You send them a letter and say, per your instruction, I'm not taking the deposition. And I understand that you have your internal reasons. That's all. Okay, so does that give you a whole
thing it's a about whole lot. A whole lot of information there. And great pieces to learn, especially like you mentioned, for new lawyers coming up. And also for individuals maybe entering a case to just sometimes, you know, trust your lawyer, be honest. It's in your best interest to tell them everything you can.
Right.
And just be straightforward.
Right.
And trust your lawyer. Try not to control the case. Just let them do their job.
We go back to my friend Alvin Krasny, who said at the beginning of this whole story, they all can't be winners.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I can't wait for our next episode, Lewis. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you very much, Jeanette.